Now, I normally give this particular pair of lectures later in the semester, but I was talking to some students in my office yesterday and I thought, why don't I move this up? And the basic issue is that we can't afford to ignore all the people in the world who have money that they could spend on our products just because they don't speak our language. And it's a little bit jarring. You know, you grow up in a country and you speak the language. And then you go somewhere else and you haven't a clue. Okay, my tip for travellers is the first word you learn should be toilet. The second word should be men or women as appropriate. Okay. So I was in a hotel room in Göteborg, I think it was, and I saw this in my hotel room. And it went on from there. Okay, you're in the hotel room. On the way to the hotel room, you've learned that the word hiss means lift. Oh, that's clearly related to our hoist. That's easy. What the heck does this mean? What are we supposed to do about it? Okay. Now, this is the experience most people in the world have when, by the way, I hope there's nobody here who does speak Swedish. Because it wouldn't work for you. This is the experience most people in the world have when they try to use a program that is trying to talk to them in English. You know, when I was a teenager, I read I read Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, and I tried to read War and Peace, and I gave up. Because amongst other things, the characters all had these weird-looking names. I managed to pronounce Raskolnikov, but I couldn't remember most of the other names. So this character does something and this character does something. I can't remember if they're the same character. Okay, and so this thing in the user interface does something, and later on, this thing doesn't. Is it the same thing? I can't remember. So what does this... This looks scary, right? Well, we can actually figure out a few things. This word at the front looks a bit like help. Oss looks a bit like us. Swedish and English are in the same language family. At, I happen to know, is sort of that. Help us, that means something there. That's going to be our. Milieu is a word that Swedish and English both borrowed from French, and it means your surroundings, social or physical, in this particular case, environment. So help us to something or other, our environment. Now that's got to be look after our environment, right? So something, 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 it's a please, you, your, handbook, something that you do with your hands, we will something, 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 come. Okay, it's got something to do with looking after the environment. And I've got to do something and then they'll do something. That much I can glean just guessing. Okay. But I'm still not getting there. I'm still struggling. It actually means help us to care our environment, to reduce the use of laundry environments. If you throw your towel on the floor in the bathroom, that means you want to have a new towel. And if you hang it up, that means you want to use it again. So they're saying, reuse your towel. Okay, it wasn't scary after all. But if all you've got is the Swedish, you don't know. You really need it in a language you can read. And by the way, I'm assuming here that none of you assume and knows anything about Swedish. You'll notice there's a letter with a couple of dots over it. Here's another one. There's a letter with a circle over it. There's another different letter with some dots over it. And here's that one again.
again, hear someone again. Now, these things look like names, but in fact they're pronouns. And capitalizing pronouns is a thing English used to do, but doesn't anymore. But there are some conventions that are like the conventions that we're familiar with. The sentences begin with capital letters and end with full stops. The colon's used in a fairly understandable way. There are conventions that aren't familiar, like beginning pronouns with a capital letter, and there are some funny letters. Okay. Here's a list of languages that I cribbed from Wikipedia last year. And you see that English is number 3 on the list. One person in 7 is counted as, how accurately I do not know, a native speaker of Mandarin Chinese. So if you want to sell to native speakers, you want your application interface to be in Chinese, because that's going to get you 3 times as many customers, assuming that they've got the money, and assuming that the Chinese government is willing to tolerate your application, so it better not be BitTorrent or a network anonymizer or anything like that. But, I mean, seriously, that's too big a market to ignore. Spanish is ahead of English. I've distinguished here between the Latin and English scripts. They're very, very closely related. They're not exactly the same. And then, of course, we've got Finnish. India's a big place. Lots of people. I think by now India has more people than China. Amazing. Then we've got Arabic. Now, when one says English, one has to be aware that there's more than one English. Linguists actually talk of the Englishettes. We used to have a couple of people from South Africa in the department. We've got people from elsewhere, but Australians love gambling, but they never take a chance. They take chances. Okay. There are sound differences. My vocabulary and grammar are very, very close to British English, but my vowels are quite different. So there's, in the same way, the various Arabic languages are very different. Portuguese are typing. Sorry, this went through tools and it's got mangled on the way, so about that. Bengali and Hindi are very closely related, but they actually use different scripts, and Russian, of course, uses Cyrillic. These will get you quite a lot of people. However, it's not just native speakers, of course. You know, it's a strange thing, but foreigners are quite smart. You'd almost think they were human. People all around the world can learn English. You wouldn't think it, would you? Well, I can't learn Mandarin, and I've tried, but I probably haven't tried hard enough. Certainly I didn't start early enough. Spanish isn't so hard. I used to know about 80 words of Hindi. I've forgotten most of them all. But if we look at total speakers, including people who speak it as a second language or a third language and can sort of get by it, yes, is that a question or just a stretch? English is now at the top of the list with 2,000 million. Mandarin is still very close to the top. There's a lot of people. About one person in 6 can get by in Mandarin. Okay, now if you add these up, I've forgotten what they come to about half of the world's population. So you're not going to get everybody with just these, but you're going to get quite a lot of them. These are, now it's quite interesting that only these two are not in the Indo-European language family. But that helps much less than you would think.
much less than you would think. English is, in many ways, one of the world's weirder languages. It has a huge vocabulary. It's picked up structural properties from several places. It's lost most of the distinguishing characteristics of Indo-European languages. We've still got a little bit of a trace of ablaut. We say man, men, but that's pretty much all that's left. So the first thing here is, look, forget money. It's just not wrong. It's just not right to make people struggle. Okay. You don't want people to go home at the end of the day tired and frustrated, and they kick the dog or strangle the gerbil or whatever it is they do to relieve their tension because they were forced to use your software. Selfishly, sensible people won't pay for programs that are hard to use. And we've got these two concepts which people abbreviate in these jokey ways. Internationalization, or I18N, means taking your program and either designing it this way or stripping out the things that tie it to a particular language, culture, and script. You want the core of your program to talk to people through an abstract interface that doesn't depend on these things. Okay, now I'll give you an example here that's not language. I've enjoyed eating in quite a few Chinese restaurants, and red is a very popular colour in Chinese restaurants because I'm oversimplifying here because, of course, there's variation. To us, white means purity, red means danger. Apparently, and I say this because this is what I've been told, in China, white is a colour associated with funerals, and red means good luck. So you go into a Chinese restaurant and they want to make you feel that you're lucky to be there, that you're going to get good luck as a result of being there. And so they paint it the colour that says, hey, danger. But you want to make your you want to clearly separate out. Here is the business logic of what my program is all about. Here is the general framework of the user interface. And here are the actual words and formats that we use to communicate with the user. Because the next step after internationalization is localization, adapting it to a different culture. You want somebody who is not an expert in your program, probably not even an expert in your programming language, to be easily able to take your program and translate it. Now, there's an issue here in New Zealand. We wish to support, to preserve the Maori language. So here I am using a Macintosh. Why can't I select Maori? Why can't I have all these menu thingies showing up in Maori? Well, I could, but somebody's got to do it. Okay, and oddly enough, the Macintosh system has been very well designed to make this comparatively straightforward. In fact, by now, all the major operating systems support internationalization and localization. They all have some way for you to separate out the text and the pictures that are used in one particular environment and let you replace them with different text and pictures for a different environment. So, there's a whole lot of things that you know that aren't true. Let's bring this up. ASCII code chart. Let's see if we can find one of these. Here we've got a table of all the ASCII characters, and it's only bulked out because they've written the number several different ways. So we've got a bunch of control characters. I used to be able to recite things. I used to know the names and the numbers. Then we've got space, a few punctuation marks, and numbers and arithmetic signs. And then we've basically got a block of capital letters and a block of lowercase letters and some brackets and braces. These things were actually laid out so that
side, you could actually change by flipping one bit. And then we've got the delete character set. So this character set here,
this is ASCII. I don't know what they put in textbooks now. The last time I looked, programming textbooks would typically end with a table showing the ASCII code chart. Now, ASCII, American Standard Code for Information Interchange, was finalised in 1967. It's the foundation for most later character sets, but it is only a foundation. It's 7 bits. Why 7 bits? Because the 8th bit was used as a parity check, typically. This isn't really adequate for English. We don't have proper quotation marks. We've got left and right quotation marks in English. In fact, we've got 2 sets of quotation marks. They're not here. So we've got some compromises in the ASCII character set. If we look at this character, conventionally called double quote, that's got 3 dots. At the beginning of a word, it's opening quote. At the end, it's closing quote. And ASCII lets you combine characters by using backspace. So if you say double quote backspace A, that gives you an A with the 2 dots over it. It was designed to work that way. Similarly, the comma does double duty as the cedilla for French. There's the back quote character here, and everybody from an English-speaking background looks at that rather puzzled and says, what's that doing there? The answer is, it's to be an accent in French. Using backspace and... Where did it go? The circumflex character. I'm sick of people calling it a carrot. It's a carré, C-A-R-E-T, an E, not an A. What's that for? The people who designed the C programming language looked at it and said, you've got no idea what this is for. We need an exclusive or, let's use it for that. Other programming languages use it for exponentiation, or even for the form of a return statement. But it's really there for making French characters. Well, that wasn't even enough for English, let alone French or German, and certainly it didn't work terribly well for Swedish. So the next thing was Latin 1. And this goes on with some more control characters. These characters here that are blanky do actually have meanings. And then we've got a bunch of extra characters. An unbreakable space, an inverted exclamation mark, the Spanish cent sign, pound sterling, the general currency sign, which I was told is pronounced chen, yen sign, broken bar, section sign, a spacing pair of dots, copyright symbol, 2 bits for French quotes. You'll find people calling for guillemot, which is a kind of C, but it's a guillemot. The negation symbol, a soft hyphen, which says if you want to break a line, the hyphen materializes as a hyphen. Don't write the line, it doesn't materialize. We've got a degree symbol, plus or minus a whole bunch of things. And then we get a whole lot of accented letters. Okay. So we get an extra 96 letters, well, an extra 64 letters. Well, actually, 62. There's a little bit, something a bit funny here. You see this rather odd thing here, where you've got capital O with an accent, capital O, capital O, capital O, capital O with an accent, capital O with a variation, and in the middle of that, there's the multiplication sign. This was actually based on a character set devised by Digital Equipment Corporation, and in the digital version, they had the OE ligature there as an œuvre or œuf in French, and apparently the French representative on the ISO committee said, we don't need it. Legend has it that he was shot when he got home. But when the committee got told, well, we don't need this thing, they said, oh, great, we can put in a couple more mathematical symbols. And so we've got the proper multiplication sign instead of star, and we've got a proper division sign instead of slash. And we've got a whole lot of interesting characters. But that wasn't enough. With 8 bits, we still... And we'll get back to... Where did it go? Here we go. Ka-ching. Okay. So Swedish has 29 letters in two cases. And we've got the A with ring, the... Okay, so Swedish can be handled using Latin 1. My mother's father came from a place called Tucepi, which is near Dubrovnik. Actually, the family came from a village called Kovici, and his surname was Kovic. And that's got a C with a sort of V on the top, which isn't available on English typewriters, so he got called Kovic instead of Kovic. But Croatian actually has 3 cases for some letters. Okay, this character look like combinations of D and J, but they are counted as distinct letters. And there's about 3 or 4 of these characters. The reason they've got these combinations is that the sound value was copied from the Cyrillic alphabet, but then they said, what are we going to do with titles? So we put something into all caps, it goes from this. This is lowercase, this is uppercase, and this is what we put at the beginning of a word when the rest of the word is in lowercase. German has the SZ character. It looks a bit like a Greek beta, but it isn't. It doesn't have a tail. So Latin 1 has lots of letters in 2 cases, and 2 of them, that one and Y the lumina, don't have an uppercase version. Now, straight away, there's a problem. What happens if you're comparing strings and you want to ignore alphabetic case? A lot of people in the real world used to do this by converting the strings to uppercase. But that doesn't work when you've got lowercase letters that don't have an uppercase. Okay? Good practice is to convert the strings to lowercase if you want to ignore case. Then we've got, so Arabic letters actually have 4 forms, not 2. There's isolated. Then there's a form that's used at the beginning of a block of letters. There's a form that's used at the end. And there's a form that's used in the middle. Initial, medial, final. Even Greek, the letter S in Greek, the sigma, has 2 different forms depending on whether it's at the middle of a word or the end. At the end of a word, it looks a bit like an S. In the middle of a word, it looks a bit more like an O. And the letter beta has a different form in the middle. Hebrew has quite a few things that vary. And English used to... Have you ever seen a chunk of English text in which there's a letter that looks like a lowercase F, but there's a stalk only on one side, not on the other, the crossbar? That's not an F, it's an S. It's the long S. Chinese doesn't have any cases at all. And it's got thousands of characters. Okay. So when you learn to deal with 8-bit characters, there are things that you learn about characters that simply aren't true. Now, here's why I want to start a book circulating around.
This is the Unicode standard version 2. And up to here is explaining how it works, and the rest of it is tables of characters. Now, I've also got, I think, Unicode 6. In Unicode 6, and the Unicode 6 book is about 50% bigger than this. It doesn't contain any code tables. It's the equivalent of this bit. So take a quick flip through, table of contents, maybe some code charts, pass it on. When you're writing code in a modern system, when you're using Windows, when you're using Linux, when you're using OS X, when you're using a mail program these days, when you're using HTML, you are using Unicode. And it has this stunningly complex character set standard. I would really like to spend 2 or 3 weeks talking about Unicode because it's really complicated. One of the things you know in English is that words are separated by blanks. In fact, that's how the WC program defines blanks. Information retrieval programs like Google for languages using some version of, let's say, Hebrew, Arabic, the Latin script, whatever, define a word as basically a sequence of letters. There may be some clues about where the beginning of things are. But in Chinese, they don't put spaces between words because words are 1 or 2 characters. And you just know which ones are words and which ones don't. Otherwise, you're not educated. Unicode contains several characters that don't occupy any space at all on your screen or paper. They're zero width. How many people here have heard of the Amazing Randi? He's a prominent skeptic, the founder of the James Randi Educational Foundation. He's the guy who offers a prize of $1 million to anybody who can demonstrate a real supernatural power, like dowsing, whatever. And his real name is not Randi, it's Zwinge. And I like to joke that he's the only magician to have his name immortalized in Unicode, the zero-width non-joiner, the ZWNJ character. So there's a zero-width space which separates words, and there's a zero-width joiner which controls the shapes of the letter on either side, but doesn't break the word into two parts. And then there's a zero-width non-joiner that doesn't join things, but also is zero-width. You know that there are 10 decimal digits. So it's easy to convert between digits and numbers. But in Unicode 4, which was when I last bothered to count, and I think in Unicode 8 or 9 there were about 50-some versions of the dish. There were 37 versions of digit 3. Okay. A simple little thing like saying, okay, how am I going to convert the number 5 to a character? Just adding apostrophe 0 apostrophe does not work. So when you're writing a number out, how do you know what numbers, what digits to use? So what happened here is we had a history of different character sets. It started in, I think, the 19th century with telegraphy, with people trying to send text messages down a wire. You've probably heard of Morse code, the famous SOS. The Bordeaux code is a much more computer-friendly code. It takes 5 bits per character, and three of the combinations are reserved for shifting. So there's an uppercase block, there's a lowercase block, and there's a digits and punctuation marks block. And it was still used in radio teletype. In the 20th century, when they were starting to build computers, they used 6-bit character sets. A very common situation was a computer with 36 bits per word containing 6 characters, each having 6 bits. BCD didn't contain lowercase letters, or less than, or greater than, or a whole bunch of other things. In 1963, we got the first draft of ASCII, and in 1967, we got the final version of ASCII, and the basic model here, the model that makes sense of ASCII is that a computer is a network-connected teletype. You've got codes that represent printable characters. You've got codes that tell the machine how to move on the paper to move
the typewriter head backwards or back to the left margin or scroll up a bit. And you've got things like start of heading, start of text, end of transmission, acknowledge, negative acknowledge, which are for network communication. Okay. So that was a very simple, straightforward model. ISO 889 was an 8-bit character set family. I've shown you one with a whole bunch of letters for various European languages. There are actually about 16 members of the family. There's an ISO Greek one. There's an ISO Cyrillic. There's an ISO Arabic, and so on. But we ended up with hundreds, over 1,000, in fact, 8-bit character sets in use. And as you might expect, that became unwieldy. It became really quite nasty. Let's say you were an Orthodox priest wanting to write articles, and you might want to quote somebody in Russian, so you need Cyrillic, and you might want to quote some of the original Greek texts, and you might want to be writing the bulk of your article in English, and sorry, you could not have all three scripts in one 8-bit character set. There just isn't room. So you have to have a scheme where you would switch character sets on the fly. So if you just landed somewhere in the middle of the file, you had no idea how to decode what you were looking at. You just didn't know what the character set was. So they said, right, let's have one standard. And so ISO 10646 was born, and it was to be a 31-bit character set, and a number of manufacturers, including IBM and Apple and Microsoft, rebelled, and they said our customers may be willing to tolerate characters doubling in size and taking up twice as much memory and twice as much disk, but they are not going to tolerate quadrupling in size. We're not going to put up with this. Here's another book. This book describes Unicode 3. I found that book enormously valuable. I wish I'd come across it years ago. So the Unicode Foundation was split off as a rival organization. And they said, we are going to make a 16-bit character set. And one of the things we're going to do when we do that is to unify characters. If two characters have the same historical origin, we will have one code point for that. So they said Chinese and Japanese and Korean, the CJK scripts, a single character may look different in the different scripts, but it means the same thing and it has the same origin. We will use the same code point for it. However, they said we want round-trip conversion. If we take any existing standard, then it must be possible to translate from that standard into Unicode without confusing characters, and to translate back into the original character set, again, without loss of information. So every distinction that had ever been made had to be preserved. So we ended up with absurdities like the unit of measure, the angstrom, which is a capital A with a ring above, that is historically nothing other than the initial letter of Mr. Angstrom's surname, which is a Swedish, or possibly some other Scandinavian, A with ring. But some character set somewhere encoded them as different characters with different properties. They said, that's a letter and that's a symbol. So Unicode has two characters that look exactly the same, but they're different. In the same way, talking about measurement, there's the micron, or the micrometer. And the micro sign is nothing other than a Greek lowercase letter M. But because they got distinguished in some standard or other, Unicode has two characters that look exactly the same. But they are different characters with different properties. And if you think that makes life hard, you're not there yet. Okay. So eventually, Unicode and ISO 10646 kissed and made up. It became quite clear that Unicode was succeeding in the marketplace, and if Unicode and ISO 10646 weren't going to be basically the same thing. There wasn't going to be an ISO 10646. So they said, okay, ISO 10646 is made up of several planes, and each plane is 16 bits worth of characters, and Unicode is the basic multilingual plane of this. It's ASCII to ISO 10646's Unicode, and that didn't last very long. By now, Unicode contains, the current version of Unicode is Unicode 10.0, came out this year. And Unicode and ISO 646 are basically the same thing. They're managed by different organizations, but they keep them pretty much aligned. There is no practical difference worth considering, really, between them. And so we've got 136,690 characters in the current international character set. That's not just more than 16 bits can hold, it's more than 17 bits can hold. Okay. Now, C had a character type, char, and the one thing you couldn't safely put in it was a character, because it wasn't defined whether char was signed or unsigned. One of my favourite tricks for students was to take a program and feed it a file containing a Y umlaut, which had Latin 1 code 255, which, if they weren't careful, would turn up in their program as minus 1, which looked like end of file, and so their program would stop too soon. WCHAR-T was introduced for wide characters. For a certain time, it was effectively 16 bits. Now it really needs to be 32 bits. Java was born at the wrong time. Java was born when Unicode was 16 bits and looked as though it might stay that way, because they really wanted it to stay that way. So in Java, a char is 16 bits, and that's not enough now. There are too many characters. I will ask about this in the exam. There are too many characters to represent using one Java char. What integer type can you use to hold a character in Java? Int will do, long will do, char will no longer do. And they had to extend the interface of string to say, well, give me the code point that's there, not the char that is there. How do they deal with storing that many characters? Well, there's a block of characters used in pairs to give you the high 10 bits and the bottom 10 bits of the character. Ada has 8, 16, and 32-bit characters. So here's some of the things that got added in Unicode. How many of these things do you think you might know about? Mandaic. What's mandaic? No.
If you look at that, you'll see it's way too small.
It's the script used by the Mandaean religion, and it's a descendant of Aramaic. Batak, I haven't the faintest clue. Ethiopic, I know what Ethiopic is. It's the script for Ethiopia, of course. Brahmi is the historic script from which most Indic scripts are derived. Barmum, I've got no idea. Kana supplement, that's to do with Japanese. Playing cards, yes, there are character codes for every one of the playing cards. Miscellaneous symbols and pictographs, emoticons. Curse of Japanese telecommunications company. They've lumbered us with a vast array. Is this the class that I told about? There is now an official international standard character, meaning vampire. Okay. Did we really need that? Transport map symbols, alchemical symbols. They keep on adding more Chinese and Japanese. 16 bits is this many hexadecimal digits, so this is in plane 2. All the things with the 1, they're in plane 1. These things are in plane. These things are in plane 0. And in fact, if we look at the growth of this, this thing has just exploded, right? There's a whole lot more scripts to go in. And, okay. One of the things that you know from the work that you've already done with characters is that a character and a code point are the same thing. In fact, I'm missing something here. There's glyph, grapheme, coded character, code, byte, and I should have said grapheme cluster. Okay. Oh, yeah. When you're processing Aston 1, it's pretty simple. You step through an array of bytes, one byte at a time, and those are your characters. So if we do something like even cute size is two graphemes, there is a letter E grapheme, that's a drawn thing, that's the graph part, that has semantics, that's the N part. And so in English, that thing means strings. So this E. In French, it's one letter, it's a different letter from the letter E. Okay. So a single character may be one or two codes in Unicode. A code may be sorted as 1 to 4 bytes. So this character here, while we've fallen out, there's one code that means that character. Or you can have two codes where this one says lowercase y, and this one says put two dots above it. This thing is what they call a floating dime protocol. And you can stack any number of floating dime protocols above, below, beside, around, even, a character. There is no upper bound on the number of dime protocols that you're allowed to add to a character. Indicant scripts have, you have your consonants as your main line of characters, and then the vowels are written sort of around, above, and below, or even inside a character. So one glyph, one unit of stuff on the screen may count as two letters. So here's some examples. If we ask how long is this, there are 7 code points there because the LJ combination, so those are those Croatian letters that I mentioned. So there's one code point meaning LJ. There's another code point there meaning LJ. Is that one letter or two letters? My father's middle name, John Aeneas Byron O'Keefe. In English script, that's one letter, the letter H. But in ASCII, it had to be written as two letters, an A followed by an E. How long did we count that? This thing, we've got the letter A with an arrow above it. And most people say, well, that's one letter, or one grapheme word, one thing, but it's got two code points. Okay, so there's all sorts of... Here we've got one code point, an omega with an iota subscript, and I think that's the Tynos accent that you might find in Greek. But is that one letter? Well, omega, long O, and iota, I... Surely they're letters. Is that two letters or is that one character? I don't know. Okay, the very question, how long is a string, suddenly becomes a very complex and confusing thing. How do we deal with this? And this is a general thing that crops up again and again in this pair of lectures. Other people have the same problem. Many of these problems have been solved. There is a library code to do it. And use that code. Don't roll your own. Now, that's a do as I say, not as I do, because I have rolled my own as an exercise in learning in great detail about this stuff, and it's much harder than you might realise. I really don't recommend it unless you want to become an expert in this area, which I am still not. I know enough about it to know trouble when I see it coming. One thing you want to do is to step through strings by characters. The definition of a grapheme cluster is when the user presses the move forward one character key in his editor or her editor, a grapheme cluster is the thing you should move over. And by the way, there is no upper bound on the number of characters that can be in a grapheme cluster. Comparing strings is a nightmare. In the old ASCII days, we used strcomp in C, but that only really made sense for English, sort of, because it put the capital letters before the lowercase letters. If you used EBCDIC,
It was the other way around. The lowercase letters appeared before the uppercase letters. And in dictionaries, of course, you found the things together. It's not pretty. In C these days, you're supposed to use a function called strcol. And because it's, I mean, the ISO standard, to compare two strings in English takes four passes. Pass one, you just look at the letters, ignoring non-letters, ignoring alphabetic case, ignoring accents. Pass two, you do it again, this time paying attention to accents. Pass three, you do it again, this time paying attention to case. And then pass four, this time you look at all the characters. French takes four passes, just like English. In fact, the same four passes, except that in French, the second pass runs right to left instead of left to right. In the ISO standard that I looked at, and I've still got a copy of somewhere, you could take up to seven passes over two strings to compare them. I mean, this is nightmare. You do not want to write that code. There's really good coverage for this in Java. It's almost the best reason to use Java. Dates and times. The issue here is that is actually threefold. There are three basic problems, and two of them are dealt with by existing library code in C. The third one is dealt with in recent versions of Java, but wasn't dealt with originally. Okay. Problem number one, what format do you use to display year, month, and day? Problem number two, what is the year number? How do you number the years? You can measure the length of each year in the same way and still disagree about how to number them. So, and issue number three is, what is the calendar? The Julian calendar and the Gregorian calendar are not the same. The Orthodox, or at least some of the Orthodox churches, called the New Calendarists in the 1920s. I was told they adopted the Gregorian calendar instead of the Julian calendar. No, they adopted something called the Revised Julian Calendar, which matches the Gregorian calendar now and will for another couple of centuries, but then they drift apart because the Revised Julian Calendar is more accurate than the Gregorian calendar. So the answer is, use library code to read and write dates, and use the formatting letters that let the user say what format they want to see. Now, the big problem here is that C doesn't have anything to deal with any calendar other than the Gregorian calendar. In particular, it doesn't have anything to deal with the Islamic calendars, and there's about eight arithmetic Islamic calendars, and there's the real one, which you can't really do on a computer anyway. There's more calendars than you would believe. How do you write times? Do you use a colon to separate dates and hours and minutes? Do you leave no characters? Do you use decimal points? Do you use AM, PM, a 12-hour clock, or a 24-hour clock? And I find it really weird. People in Europe using the 24-hour clock, but wearing wristwatches that show the 12-hour time. Very strange. But again, you want to give people what they can read. You want to read what they can write. ISO 8601 is an international standard that describes a format for dates and times that can be understood by machines. And I've got some files here, a summary that I got from somewhere else in the 1988 and 2001 editions, which are now obsolete, and which ISO made available free. So I can give that to you, but you've got your year, your month, your day, then T, then hours, minutes, seconds, fractional seconds, and time zone offset. And our offset here is plus 1200 at the moment and plus 1300 in the summer. And if you throw out punctuation marks and you sort on these things, it sorts perfectly correctly. Yes.
What do the square braces mean?
Optional. Yep.
I mean, the ultimate thing here is these ones, right?
And this is really when I should finish, and we're not quite done here. One thing I want to say is that many programming languages have built-in types for dealing with dates and times. For example, in JavaScript, there's a date and time data type. I can't remember what it's called. In SQL, you've got these things. In Smalltalk, you've got date and time, and duration. Scheme has date and time, again, duration. C has quite a few. There's clock T, which is typically microseconds of CPU time, time T, which is typically seconds of real-world time, and struct TM, which is a decoded time. POSIX adds more things with higher resolution. And Java has a huge number of things. In particular, current versions of Java have support for several non-Gregorian calendars. If you want to sell a program to Buddhists, it would be courteous to support the Buddhist calendar, which is in there. The older date and calendar and time zone classes were broken by design. I felt ever so smug that my small talk code was much better than Java. And then Java leapfrogged me. But it's the same thing here. Here is a problem. Different people write dates and times in different ways. If you want to deal with that, it's probably a bad idea to write your own code. Find out what support there is in your language and use that. Do not try to do arithmetic on calendar dates. It is just amazingly hard. You do not want to do that. If you need to do arithmetic with dates, keep them as Julian day numbers. Look that up. And there's this really fantastic book. It's gone through several editions. Canonical Calculations by Nathan Dushowitz and Edward Reingold. I found it enormously interesting, enormously useful, and I have implemented about half of the calendars described in that book, and the others are currently in the too hard basket. And I think we'll stop here. One of the reasons why I say it's really important to understand these things, it turns out that a lot of people don't. In particular, there was an actual international standard for a certain programming language, and I was trying to build a library for it, to conform to the standard, and they said that the range of time zone offsets was minus 12 hours to plus 12 hours. Well, we can be plus 13 hours. The Chatham Islands can be plus 13 hours and a half an hour. And there's a place called the Line Islands that can be 14 hours ahead of UTC. So, yeah. There are problems with the very way they structured it, that there is a difference between a time zone and an offset. So if the representation they chose doesn't actually let you do data arithmetic, but it requires you to. But there's a huge thing here about universal time coordinated. Or coordinated universal time. And that is, I'm closing this window now to emphasize this really is where I want to stop. UTC has leap seconds. How many of you know what a leap second is? One, two, three. Do you know anything about the rules for leap seconds? Trick question, there are no rules. Okay. There can be up to four leap seconds in a year. So far, there have been zero, one, or two in December or July. December or June, sorry. And the thing is that the Earth as a clock is a bit wobbly. And it's slowing down. And so we've got atomic time, TAR. And that ticks along absolutely regularly. It keeps the physicists happy. But the Earth gradually drifts out of synchronization with atomic time. So UTC is atomic time, tweaked occasionally by adding extra seconds, so that despite what they told you in school, some minutes contain 61 seconds. This is one of the reasons arithmetic on dates is particularly hard. And there is no rule. For leap years, we've got a rule that says when these things occur, but for leap seconds, the International Earth Rotation Service keeps track of how far things have got, and whenever atomic time and Earth rotational time, whenever UTC and Earth rotational time would be out by, I think it's more than 0.8 of a second, they add an extra second. And it's unpredictable when that will happen. So, in fact, if you want to calculate a time in the future and report it in UTC, technically, you have to predict the future. If you can do that, why are you writing computer programs? And yet, this international standard that I mentioned requires...